From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is
War News Radio.
I'm Alan Zhao.
And I'm Robert Holoka.
This week on War News Radio, Cash in Hand, we hear from an Australian who worked as a regional manager for an Afghan development agency.
Then we look at the implications of Muqtada al-Sadr's return to Iraq.
Finally, we talk with Sergeant Leo Dunson about a YouTube video he posted that has created some controversy.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Protests inspired by anti-government uprisings across the Middle East continue throughout Iraq this week. Thousands in Soleimaniyah, in the Kurdish region of northern Iraq, have taken to the streets, calling for the removal of Kurdish regional president Massoud Barzani. Among their grievances are unemployment, inadequate government services, and excessive force used by the military to repress previous protests. Three people have been killed and at least 100 injured to date. The Kurdistan regional government has agreed to meet with the opposition. There have also been protests in Kirkuk, Baghdad, and Basra.
In response to the protests, the Iraqi government has diverted a budget for combat jets to its rationing program, added more sugar to food rations, and promised free nationwide electricity. The Iraqi parliament will also not meet this week. Instead, it is agreed that legislators will work for a week in their provinces to look for solutions to the outcries.
A suicide bomber in the Iraqi city of Samarra drove a car filled with explosives into police headquarters, leaving at least 12 policemen dead and 20 wounded. The victims were members of an elite squad assigned to protect Shia pilgrims during a commemorative ceremony at the prominent Al-Askari Mosque. The bombing is the latest in a series of attacks on the mosque and surrounding areas, coming only 9 days after a suicide bomber killed 36 pilgrims. Local officials blame Al-Qaeda for the attacks, but so far no group has claimed responsibility. Another car bomb, also attributed to Al-Qaeda, occurred at a Sunni mosque in the Ninvia province, killing two.
BP and its partner China National Petroleum Corporation will be the first to be reimbursed for developing Iraq's Rumaila oil field. Over the past 14 months, the Iraqi government signed 12 contracts with various corporations in order to increase oil production of the field. BP alone plans to invest $15 billion in Rumaila over the next 20 years. The government will begin reimbursement when the Rumaila field begins producing at least 10% above the original output.
A suicide bombing in the Kunduz province of northern Afghanistan left 30 dead, including three police and at least 40 others wounded. The victims were in line for identification cards outside a government office, and the Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack. Kunduz has been a base for the Taliban insurgency for the past 2 years.
64 civilians, mostly women and children, were killed during operations led by NATO and Afghan troops in the eastern province of Kunar. U.S. military officials say that there is a high probability the intended insurgent targets were neutralized during the attack. NATO airstrikes and night raids have caused high civilian casualties in the past, leading to controversy and tension with the Afghan government. NATO has tightened the rules governing such operations over the past years, resulting in fewer civilian casualties.
Gunmen and suicide bombers attacked a Kabul bank office in the eastern city of Jalalabad. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the attack, which killed at least 40 civilians, police, and Afghan army soldiers. The targeted bank was responsible for handling the salaries of Afghan security forces. This attack is the deadliest since June 2010, and the worst Taliban attack in the province's history. Violence against civilians and security forces is at its highest level since the Taliban were removed from power in 2001.
The Afghanistan High Council for Peace has announced plans to send a delegation to Guantanamo Bay Prison to negotiate for the release of Taliban prisoners, including at least one top insurgent commander. The council was established by President Karzai to facilitate disarmament talks with the Taliban and encourage the organization's acceptance of the Afghan constitution, though the Taliban has refused to participate in the peace process. While the U.S. Embassy supports the council's efforts, officials caution that the plans require comprehensive review.
U.S. government officials have confirmed that Raymond Davis, a U.S. citizen being held in Lahore, Pakistan, for murder, is a CIA-employed private contractor. Previously, U.S. sources had claimed that Davis was merely a diplomat who got caught up in an armed robbery. Pakistani officials have accused Davis of spying and claimed that the two men he killed were Pakistan intelligence officers. However, U.S. officials insist that he has diplomatic immunity and is thus immune from prosecution.
The U.S. Commission on Wartime Contracting reported that the military contractor system remains wasteful despite President Obama's 2009 promise to curb reliance and improve oversight. The report stated that tens of billions of dollars given to private contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan never reached their intended use. The report recommends the creation of an inspector general to monitor projects and review companies' past behavior before awarding contracts. The government has given $177 billion to contractors since 2001.
This is War News Radio. Economic development is crucial to the counterinsurgency effort in Afghanistan. According to the Congressional Research Service, the U.S. Agency for International Development has sent $20 billion in foreign aid to Afghanistan since the war began in 2001. Where does all that money go? Jared Nolan got the inside story from the former regional manager of a U.S. aid-funded development group.
Imagine you live in a rural Afghan village. The Taliban is in firm control of the district, and news spreads like wildfire through the village, so you know they're aware of your every move. If one day, a large international convoy pulls up to your house, soldiers hop from their Humvees and knock on your door, would you answer? In most cases, the answer is no.
There's a lot of nervousness from the locals in terms of being seen to interact with the military, and the way that we operated was we blended into the community. So I can tell you now that I look like a member of the Taliban. I look like an Afghan. I had a big beard, turban. I drove a beaten-up white Corolla. So you blend it in.
That's Jason Thomas, an Australian who, for 9 months during 2009 and 2010, served as the regional manager for the Central Asia Development Group in Southeast Afghanistan. His job was to implement a range of development projects that employed local Afghan laborers. The work was slow and never easy, but he managed to accomplish a large number of functional projects. The first step was getting the locals on board. Thomas did this by meeting with elders and leaders in each area.
When you are first going to meet with members of a particular district or village and obtain their ideas for what they'd like to do in their area to improve their infrastructure, and you can get them all to have assure and agree what piece of infrastructure, what project they want to commit to. That's quite important because they've got some buy-in to that. You know, that's really important as opposed to going and telling them what we think they need.
Even this planning process was slow, however.
It won't take one shura, I can tell you that. Anyone who's worked in Afghanistan knows that it'll take three, four, or five meetings. That's why that book's called Three Cups of Tea. It takes at least three or four cups of tea before you get to the nub of the issue. But once you get to that, then they have some buy-in.
Thomas also got support from the village leadership by offering a cash-for-work scheme. To carry out the project the elders agreed on, Thomas hired local laborers and paid them directly every fortnight. There are many benefits to this type of program.
We pay the laborers directly, cash in the hand. So it doesn't go through any government agency. It doesn't go through any third party. And I tell you what, once you start paying these people money in the hand, it becomes a great struggle for them to be enticed away to participate in terrorist activities or to participate in the insurgency because they've got cash in the hand, no one's interfering with them, and they're able to feed their family.
Thomas was able to employ up to 500 or 600 workers in some places for 6 months. Over the three provinces Thomas managed, he estimated for the 9 months he was there, the projects employed 7,000 Afghans. Most of them involved jobs like roading, cleaning, and irrigation. One of the projects was even planting 30,000 trees in Ghazni to rebuild a previously productive pine plantation. All these projects served as part of the counterinsurgency effort by luring fighting-age men with no jobs and little education off the battlefield with a reasonable salary rate. On top of that, Thomas was also able to employ 500 women in Ghazni with three projects.
One was refurbishing the Ghazni hospital, which we completely refurbished it. Two was refurbishing the orphanage. And in fact, the third one, lest I forget, was making all the school uniforms and nursing uniforms for the school children in Ghazni and all the doctors and nurses in Ghazni. So that was a pretty substantial project, and it was great to be able to employ women, mainly widows, who, you know, had very few opportunities to have an income in that part of Afghanistan.
The cash for work program wasn't supported by every Afghan, however. Thomas was often subjected to substantial intimidation, but not from who you would expect.
I certainly was subjected to significant intimidation, but I say the irony because that came from a governor of one of the provinces. So I had a bounty on my head by one of the governors of the provinces that I oversaw in Afghanistan. And the intimidation from that person's office grew right up to the point until I finished working in Afghanistan.
It seems counterintuitive that a government official would want to impede the development of his own constituency, but this was Afghanistan.
I refused to be involved in any form of facilitating corruption. The fact that we paid workers directly and the money did not go through the governor's office also was seen as a slight in terms of, you know, how they saw things should be done, which I'm sure your listeners can draw the conclusions as to what might happen to the funds that go through an office like that.
Thomas says the Taliban aren't the only bad guys in Afghanistan, but whenever there's an IED, a shooting, or an illegal checkpoint, they get all the blame.
There are many levels of violence perpetuated by many different groups for many different reasons. Obviously, you do have the Taliban. Most of them want to control their local area. That's all they're interested in. They're not really interested in running Afghanistan. You have the foreign insurgency, those coming across from Pakistan, most of them are not Afghans. And then, of course, you have the criminals and thieves who've been operating free will in Afghanistan for a long time and cause a good deal of the violence, the shootings and intimidation. They're often the people who are carrying out the illegal checkpoints off the main routes that most people travel. Then, of course, you have some of the Afghan government officials who are also highly corrupt.
Thomas is back in Australia now, but he's still watching the progression and developments in Afghanistan. He also wonders what will happen to all the projects he oversaw.
You always want to ask yourself, if we build this road or we, you know, fix this building and we leave, what will happen to it? You know, will the local government have the capacity to be able to maintain it? And as we know, it's often not the case at all. Whether the national government has the capacity to maintain what the international community has rebuilt for it at this stage point in time, no, not at all.
Today, Afghanistan relies heavily on outsiders like Thomas to provide the security, know-how, and funds needed to maintain the improved infrastructure and continue developing the country. Thomas says, however, that the future holds promise. As a regional manager, he had many younger Afghans working under him, supervising the development projects, and he saw firsthand the potential of the next generation of Afghans.
But the guys who worked in their offices, you know, some of them were very smart young people, you know, really smart guys. Some of them may not have had the opportunity of education that you and I have had, understandably, but that didn't mean they weren't smart. Very smart people, you know, hardworking, real eager to learn. They just need to be provided with the direction and with the leadership and with the mentoring. And I think therein lies a great potential for a country like Afghanistan.
Thomas's work in Afghanistan is done, but the Central Asia Development Group, along with the rest of the development agencies in the country, continues to operate with the goal that eventually Afghanistan will be able to take control of its own destiny. For War News Radio, I'm Jared Nolan.
This is War News Radio. Muqtada al-Sadr has returned to Iraq for a second time this year. He recently encouraged Shiites to not participate in the protests that are taking place all over Iraq. Sam Hirschman reports on the first time al-Sadr returned to Iraq, and this piece first aired in January.
Influential Iraqi Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has opposed American intervention in Iraq since the invasion of 2003. Al-Sadr, the spiritual leader of the Mahdi army, led his followers in an armed resistance against U.S. forces and the Iraqi government until he ordered most of his forces to disarm in 2008. In 2007, al-Sadr fled to Iran. Last year, while in voluntary exile, he played an important role in the formation of Iraq's new government. In a recent speech captured by Reuters, al-Sadr and his followers proclaimed, "No, no, America." On January 5, 2011, al-Sadr returned to Iraq for the first time in over 3 years. Although al-Sadr went back to Iran again on January 21, his return to Iraq sparked varying analyses of his influence on Iraqi politics. Some analysts say he's a threatening force with a strong influence on the future of Iraq. Others disagree, saying that his power is significantly limited. Ahmed Thamer, a medical student at Baghdad University, remembers al-Sadr for his role in sectarian violence.
Muqtada al-Sadr is a leader of a terrorist gang that caused harmful sequences to the Iraqi people, including Shia and Sunni. No difference between them. Of course, its return to Iraq, its effect on people have little effect, because people here are not scared, if he returned or he is not. All the Iraqi people, what we need is to live in peace.
Recently, al-Sadr has voiced support for the new Iraqi government, and his party's members of parliament were among the first to join the coalition. This has led some commentators to believe he has strong political influence. Mohammed Bazzi, a senior fellow for Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, says al-Sadr came back to Iraq to demonstrate his power.
Well, there was something of a victory lap after he had played this role as kingmaker in ending the months of political paralysis.
On the other hand, John Scott Carpenter, a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, does not think al-Sadr has as much influence as it might look.
Politically, he's not as strong as people think he is. If you look at the electoral results, in Maliki, for instance, in Baghdad, got more votes himself as one individual than Muqtada al-Sadr's list got in total. So he's not that strong. He's still remembered as having created a great deal of strife in the south, in Basra and other provinces in the south. He still has pockets of support in Baghdad, where most of his support came from in the last elections. But he's not a tremendously strong political force.
Bazzi says what al-Sadr has done is lead a very disciplined movement.
And his supporters in the Sadr movement really played the political game very well in Iraq, both with the parliamentary elections in 2010, but also with the earlier provincial elections in 2009. And the alliances he was able to create, and the sort of political work that the movement was able to create on the ground in both elections was very significant.
Carpenter agrees that al-Sadr's movement could gain significant power on a more local level.
Groups like Muqtada al-Sadr's can take advantage of disillusionment in the provinces for this lack of service delivery and push for more autonomy.
But Ahmed Sayyid, a student at the University of Technology in Baghdad, doesn't believe al-Sadr will win over the Iraqi people.
And the people would not support And
the people will not support any leader that leads the people to death and makes the people's situation worse.
Both Thamer and Sayoud think the government and country are getting stronger. Sayoud says it is only a matter of time.
It's getting better day after day.
It's getting better day after day, and the government is getting better. I think we need time.
If the new government, formed with al-Sadr's support, is not capable of keeping the country secure and providing basic services, Carpenter says al-Sadr is positioned to gain in power and influence.
Muqtada al-Sadr can be a factor because he's being very smart right now. He's saying, look, I'm supportive, I'm in, but. And I think he's banking on the fact that this government is going to fail to deliver services. And so if the government fails to do it, then I think he's going to be waiting in the wings.
But for now, al-Sadr has returned to Iran, ostensibly to finish his religious studies. For War News Radio, I'm Sam Hirschman.
This is War News Radio. War News Radio earlier reported on soldiers using YouTube to share their experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. U.S. Army Sergeant Leo Dunson was one of the soldiers we spoke to, and one of his videos has created quite a controversy. Kyle Crawford got back in touch with Dunson in this piece first aired in September.
The video, which was posted in April, begins with American soldiers from the 172nd Striker Brigade stopping an Iraqi driver at a routine checkpoint outside of Mosul in northern Iraq. After quickly planting a grenade in the man's car without his knowledge, Dunson and his partner repeatedly demand an explanation.
Hey, What is that?
The Iraqi gestures in denial. And after about 30 seconds, Dunson announces that it was all a joke and shakes hands with the relieved man. Dunson says he was surprised by the attention his video produced.
I was pretty shocked. I woke up. Honestly, I woke up to all these calls. And a lot of messages, and I had no idea what was going on.
Although War News Radio first reported on the video in July, it wasn't until Gawker.com and CNN reported on the prank last week that Dunson's video drew national attention. Gawker wrote, "It's hard to imagine Iraqis really appreciate having a grenade stuck in their trunk by U.S. soldiers, no matter how well-intended."
What they had to say in the article was pretty shocking as well. I didn't think so many people would take it so offensive.
In the wake of prisoner abuses near the outset of the war in Iraq, the U.S. military has operated under the microscope of global criticism. But Dunson suggests that his detractors are misinterpreting the video of the incident.
It was all in fun, and even the guy, he laughed with me, and that was it. You know? So it wasn't that big of a deal. I remember the day like it was yesterday. So I remember how it was. Not like he was petrified of his life kind of situation. I was there. I mean, it might look to them as though he was, but he was not petrified of his life. I mean, he did the little hold his heart. He was saying you scared me. You got me. You got me too. Ha ha ha. It's funny. You know, it wasn't, one of those things where he was really upset or mad or anything like that. I mean, you can get a vibe from people how they feel.
As a guest on Russia Today, an English language Russian TV network, American Army Colonel Joel Hamilton vehemently criticized Dunson's actions, stating that the behavior was unacceptable and would not be tolerated in his battalion. But Dunson has strong words in response.
The lieutenant colonel that goes on the TV and attempted to bash me or slam me into the ground, I can't think of his name, but he said, I would never let somebody under my unit act that way. And I'm thinking to myself, well, sir, you're not even out in the field, so you don't know what those guys are out there doing.
Dunson explains that people don't understand the pressure weighing on soldiers in Iraq. He says joking around is one way to relax and pass the time.
I'm here for a year and a half. You want me to be serious the entire time? You know what I mean? Do you want me to sit here with my gun pointed at every single person I come to and shoot and kill everybody that I come across? Is that what you guys want us to do? You know, because if that's the case, then that's how a lot of people end up dead for no apparent reason.
Dunson believes that his actions were in line with the stated U.S. mission in Iraq.
I apologize if it offended anyone, because I never did it in any intent to offend anyone. You know, and they got to realize that they talk about trying to win over the Iraqis' hearts and minds. I'm a soldier. I was actually over there on the ground. You know, I'm not one of these people that's just standing back in the field and from the newsroom saying, oh, let's try to win hearts and minds. I was over there winning hearts and minds.
Back at home, Dunson reminds us that soldiers don't always leave the experience behind.
Once you're a soldier, you're always a soldier, but yet the system treats you as if you're not a soldier anymore. And I think that that is jacked up for them to treat their people that way, because you can't train somebody how to kill for 5 years and then, once they're done, expect for them to just forget how to kill.
Following his deployment in Iraq and subsequent discharge, Leo Dunson has a new mission. Now he is an aspiring rapper whose music focuses on veteran struggles. He just released his new album, American Soldier. Dunson isn't upset about the negative media coverage. In fact, he sees this as a way to get his name and music to a greater audience.
This is an absolutely 100% good thing. There is absolutely no such thing as bad publicity. I don't care if they had me on TV, you know, whatever, you know, butt naked. You know what I mean? Like, there's no such thing as bad publicity. You can put me over there and try to throw me to the ground and say, oh, Sergeant Dunson, he's such a horrible guy. I hate this dude, blah, 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 blah. But the music speaks for itself.
His album touches on a variety of themes, but most important to Dunson are the songs that talk about the challenges soldiers face when they return from war. Dunson was homeless for a time when he came back from Iraq, and his most recent music video, I Went to War, is about homeless veterans. The attention leaves Dunson optimistic.
I'm 100% positive that it'll be a major spike in record sales, that's for sure.
Meanwhile, Dunson has taken a job at a casino in Las Vegas and continues adjusting to life after combat.
Just trying to live a normal life.
Dunson believes that his music expresses something all veterans can relate to, and that much of his support will come from the community of veterans still coming home from the war zones. You can watch the video at the center of the controversy and listen to Sergeant Dunson's music at sgtdunson.com. For War News Radio with Aaron Moser and William Lawrence, I'm Kyle Crawford.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archive shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Aaron Moser, Sam Hirschman, John McMinn, Rosanna Kim, Kate Aronoff, Caroline Batten, Eliana Bisgard Church, Amandine Lee, Emily Bryant, Lewis Katz, and Jillian Ma. Our producer is Jim McMillan. I'm Alan Zhao.
And I'm Robert Holoka. Until next time, thanks for listening.